The information shared on the Allo podcast is not intended as medical advice. Your medical care decisions should be made in consultation with your physician who is familiar with your specific case. Welcome to the Allo podcast from the Allo Hope Foundation. I'm Molly Sherwood.
And I'm Bethany Weathersby, and we are so glad that you're here.
Oh, that's so nice of you.
Wow. We
don't open with that usually. Right. We are glad.
We are so glad. We really like our followers. I wish we could see their faces, though.
Me too.
Yeah.
But I mean, it would be really embarrassing if no one was here. So I'm really glad.
Oof.
Yeah. Whoever is here, really glad you're here.
Yeah.
Okay, I've actually been looking forward to this episode because in some ways it feels like a nice big exhale. Mm. It's like we're finally talking about the phase where the baby is home in their family's arms. And even though I'm not currently in an alloimmunized pregnancy myself, we support so many women who are. And there's just something sacred about watching a baby come home. It's like a victory.
So true. I do feel like every Allo mom deserves like a round of applause, you know, going through all of that. Bringing home your HDFN baby after everything that we go through, it is a moment that can feel almost surreal, actually. I remember walking into my home with my baby in my arms and thinking, how is this real? Like, this can't be real, because you envision it so much, right? During all of those hard months. But even when we're home with that baby in our arms, there's still one last very important milestone we still need to cross. And it's one that often gets overlooked and it's kind of misunderstood, I think.
Yeah. And we want to kind of pause on that milestone today because while many people think of bringing the baby home as the end of that phase of the journey, it's really not. There's a difference between hospital discharge, whether you were in the NICU or you went home without NICU time, and being truly medically cleared from HDFN. So that final clearance is the real finish line in the HDFN relay race.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like when you think in pictures, Molly, with your relay race. Dr. Moise uses that analogy a lot too. But that's what today's episode is all about, supporting the patients and the providers while they navigate this last stretch safely. So we'll talk about the bilirubin risks, delayed anemia, outpatient monitoring, and how to know when your baby is truly in the clear, which is what we all want to know, right? It's also, I think it's a good follow-up to our NICU episode that we just had a couple of weeks ago. And this episode covers both the post-hospital discharge period, kind of, for both babies who were in the NICU and those who never needed NICU care at all, kind of like you just said, Molly.
Between the two of us, we've experienced all those versions. Some of our babies never needed phototherapy or intervention. Some stayed at bedside with mom for monitoring and care, and others required time in the NICU.
Mm-hmm. And if you're new to the podcast, we highly recommend going back and listening to Season 1, Episode 13, if you haven't already. It's a really good primer on the post-birth phase of HDFN care and really lays the groundwork for everything that we're diving into today. And also, I think, things that we covered in that NICU episode a couple weeks back.
Yes, for sure. So yeah, I would say if anyone hasn't listened to that episode before this one, that's a really good foundation. And at the heart of it, here's what we're dealing with. So after hospital discharge, babies affected by HDFN are still at risk for two major complications. The first one is hemolytic jaundice, which is also called hyperbilirubinemia. And that can spike quickly and cause severe harm if it's untreated or poorly managed. Bethany, I still think about the visual you shared in that episode we're talking about, the high bilirubin being like a tsunami, sort of fast. And it can be dangerous if it's increasing too quickly without care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those vivid, terrifying images in my brain. I remember. So bad. You know, when you're a mom of four boys, These are the conversations we're having. Anyway, the tsunami and the volcano visuals, we have them going on. So we have the Bilirubin tsunami, like you said, Molly. But then the other major risk, and I think this is probably the main one when we're talking about after hospital discharge, is the delayed onset anemia, or some people call it late anemia. And this is like the lava creeping down the side of the volcano. This anemia moves more slowly, and if you're not paying attention, it can really sneak up on you in the weeks after birth. I know that these visuals are exactly what an alloimmunized mom needs
after birth. Just natural disasters.
To calm her nerves.
That's what I want to think about.
Right? Yeah. So like comparing her postpartum journey to horrifying natural disasters. Oh, man.
But they do help us remember to be watching closely and be prepared in order to avoid them, because they are avoidable.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, so I want to start off by just already repeating something really important that Molly said like 2 minutes ago, because I really want it to sink in. Hospital discharge is not the same thing as being cleared from HDFN. Discharge just means that the baby is stable enough to continue monitoring outside of the hospital setting. The hemolysis, which is that destruction of the baby's red blood cells caused by the mom's antibodies, that can continue for weeks after birth. And that's why we have to keep monitoring and advocating for those weeks after birth too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that continued monitoring and care outside of the hospital setting will mostly be handled by the baby's regular pediatrician, usually in collaboration with a pediatric hematologist. And unfortunately, a lot of patients are discharged without clear instructions or follow-up plans from the discharging team. And this can cause parents or even the providers to feel really lost and unprepared for how to handle it next.
And we see that time and time again in our patient community, unfortunately. And yet, like we just said, being prepared is really the key. And so, you know, just like we said with the tsunami and volcano, if you know it's coming, if you know those disasters are coming, you can be ready and you can avoid the risk, basically. And so that's what we want to do in this episode. We want to help the families and providers really prepare and respond with timely, proactive monitoring and treatment if it's necessary. And then this is how we all work together to keep our HDFN babies safe. And also, in doing so, help alleviate some of the mother's burden during this really hard time.
The most urgent post-discharge concern for most HDFN babies who are discharged in the first week or two after birth is bilirubin levels. But among the babies who are in the NICU, that may happen while they're in the NICU, like we talked about last episode. So ideally, bilirubin should be followed really closely in the hospital, starting with that cord blood testing. And it's also treated in the hospital because it can increase rapidly, especially in the first week of life. But that's not always what happens. Oftentimes, HDFN babies are discharged before their bilirubin levels have actually resolved.
And there are a few reasons for that happening, for these babies potentially being discharged a bit too early before their bili is resolved. HDFN is a rare disease. I know we say it a lot, and you guys are probably so tired of hearing this, but it is a somewhat rare disease, and some clinicians may only see a handful of HDFN cases throughout their entire careers. Without consistent protocols and clear guidelines, we see a wide range of care practices and discharge practices, sometimes even within the same hospital system.
Mm-hmm. True. Another big reason is that typical newborn jaundice or elevated bilirubin is so common that it can create a false sense of safety, because the number one diagnosis in the newborn period is typical newborn jaundice, which behaves really differently from hemolytic jaundice or hyperbilirubinemia caused by HDFN. So when providers see elevated bilirubin, like they see all the time in their non-HDFN babies, they might assume it's typical newborn jaundice, and they can mistakenly base care on those common jaundice patterns. But hemolytic jaundice comes with different care requirements. It can present right after birth, it can escalate rapidly, and it's more likely to cause brain damage if not properly treated, and it can take longer to resolve because there's ongoing hemolysis going on due to the hemolytic anemia, which brings us to one of the most important safety steps that's sometimes overlooked, which is the trial off of lights. Mm-hmm. So if a baby did receive phototherapy, this is a period where the baby is taken off phototherapy before discharge, and the care team watches to see if bilirubin stays stable without treatment.
And here's why that matters with our babies. If you discharge an HDFN baby right after phototherapy without doing that trial off lights, you could miss a dangerous rebound where their levels go up. And for some HDFN babies, that bilirubin can rise sharply within 12 to 24 hours of stopping those phototherapy lights. And of course, that rebound is easier to manage in the hospital. And it's really hard to catch that rebound in time to treat safely if you're already home when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the American Academy of Pediatrics actually has specific guidance for when you're stopping phototherapy for a baby who has needed it. So if it's a baby who has had a positive DAT, which is diagnostic of HDFN, or known or suspected to have HDFN, and they've just stopped doing phototherapy, they need to have their bilirubin measured 6 to 12 hours after it stops, and then repeated again 24 hours after it stops. So the main message here for our listeners is this: if your baby was discharged from the hospital with rising bilirubin levels, or was discharged after receiving phototherapy without a trial off lights, it's super important to get your baby's bilirubin tested the very next day, and probably mm-hmm. a day or two after that, so that you have an opportunity to follow the mm-hmm. trend and see what's going on and make sure it's stabilizing in a normal range. So when it comes to HDFN, the bilirubin risk doesn't really end when the phototherapy lights go off or when the baby is discharged from the hospital necessarily. It ends when we're sure that the baby can sustain safe, normal bilirubin levels without the lights.
So true. And a quick reminder that this type of hyperbilirubinemia, it really can't be treated effectively at home with a phototherapy blanket or simply by putting your baby out in the sunshine. That's something that they did long ago when there was really no treatment for hyperbilirubinemia. It also can't be diagnosed simply by looking at the baby's skin coloring. Of course, if your baby is turning orange and you're noticing it, you should always take your baby in to have those bilirubin levels checked, especially if you're unsure. But our babies do remain orange even after they have safe bilirubin levels or they've received treatment for phototherapy. I remember being so alarmed by my son Callum. He was totally in the clear and he stayed so orange for a really long time. And so anyway, just going off of their coloring alone is not a safe way to diagnose them with high bilirubin. You got to go in and have those blood tests. Let's just pause really quickly, because I think we just said a lot about bilirubin, and I am curious to hear your own personal experience with that, Molly. I'll just share a little bit about my kids' bilirubin journeys. So I'll start with my daughter, Nora. She had 5 IUTs. She was born at 38 weeks, and in the 10 days leading up to delivery, my MFM had me take phenobarbital to kind of help develop her liver to better handle the bilirubin post-birth and try to avoid exchange transfusion. That's another full episode. So we won't go into detail on that, but I'm just saying that to kind of preface her bilirubin journey. So we knew that she had very severe HDFN and her older sister was stillborn, and so that we were taking all the precautions to help her have the best outcome. So then she was born with great, great levels. Like, she never had high bilirubin. She didn't need any NICU time. They observed her. They checked her bilirubin carefully and watched. And her highest bili level was 2.
Wow.
And so she was discharged at 48 hours old in my arms after delivery. And then we had a follow-up appointment the very next morning with a pediatrician nearby, and we were from out of state. So Dr. Moise was treating us in Texas. We live in Alabama. And he said, hey, I want you to stay close to the hospital and have this Billy checked for the 3 days after discharge, even though she's nowhere near treatment levels, her Billy isn't even rising at all. But I still want to be cautious with this because it's in that window of that tsunami kind of. And so we had her Billy checked. It was great. And then we went back the next day and then a third day and everything was normal. It wasn't rising. And then he said, okay, you can go take her home to Alabama, which was so fun. And so she had no issues with it, which is, it was very surprising because we were ready for this big battle. And this is more common, by the way, with babies who have KEL and babies who've had IUTs, because they often are fully donor blood, which means they are antigen negative donor blood and their red cells are not being destroyed by the maternal antibodies, which means there's no byproduct of bilirubin. And so then they struggle far less with this hyperbilirubinemia. Okay, then my son Callum, he was born at 34 weeks, emergency C-section, totally different story. He had very high bili levels right at birth. He needed, he had a top-up transfusion. He needed IVIG for the first 3 days and full lights. And that really took care of it. And thankfully, we didn't get close to exchange transfusion level. But my last son, this was a surprise where we struggled a lot with this portion of his care. So he was born at 37 weeks. He also had that phenobarbital and had pretty manageable bilirubin levels, but they were rising. And he had 7 IUTs. And so I was able to have him room in with me and receive phototherapy at bedside. And it was so nice for me and his dad. It was just so wonderful to not have him go to the NICU. And I think when the baby has more manageable levels, like my son August did, that could potentially be an option, although it depends on the hospital. But the strange thing was they kept checking his hemoglobin, sometimes multiple times a day. And so it was just kind of weird because I'm like, you know, I know that he's fully donor blood, you know, he's not going to need a transfusion for several weeks probably. But yeah, so that was an issue. And then after he had lights and his levels were down, they didn't want to do that trial after, before discharging us. And so that was difficult. And his care was being managed by a nurse practitioner, and she was adamant that she would not check his bilirubin before discharge.
By the way, I just can't like picture myself ever taking a position like that. Like, no, I will absolutely not check.
Right. I don't know.
I don't really get that.
Well, she was like, well, we just checked it, you know, a few hours ago, but I was trying to explain. Yeah, that's when he was under lights. He was under the phototherapy lights. So now that he's out, we have, like, I don't feel safe taking him home without checking one last time his bilirubin. Again, we were in another state, so it was like a 4-hour drive home. Anyway, and she would not. And she said, if you're not discharged now, you're going to have to stay something like another night, and like you can't stay, and then he's gonna have to anyway. So I was super stressed, and she said, I'll check his blood one last time, and she checked his hemoglobin again.
No.
Yes.
Oh,
and she
so
did
painful.
Not. She did not check his Billy. So
wow.
But again, like this was my what, 4th allo pregnancy. So I was like, okay, you know, I kind of knew to expect some bumps in the road. So thankfully I had a great pediatrician back home. I called her. I was just like, this is what's going on. She said, I'm putting in an order right now at this hospital for his bilirubin, you know, go ahead and discharge, come straight home, and then go straight to the hospital and get his bilirubin checked. And mm-hmm. that brought so much peace of mind. And so we were discharged. We went, had his Billy checked. And then she set up, you know, more bilirubin monitoring outpatient. But during my pregnancy, I had talked with my pediatrician and said, hey, you know, here's what we can expect after delivery. And we both felt prepared, you know? And
yeah.
So that was helpful.
Honestly,
what about you, Molly?
I've been so just pleased in general with my interactions with most pediatricians of their willingness to just be collaborative. Like
sure.
So many times, especially related to HDFN, they were asking me, you know, what would make you feel more comfortable? And so I'll take it. I would much prefer over somebody asserting potentially like false confidence about something. So
yeah, I think that's a sign of a really good pediatrician.
For sure. I think so too. So with my son, Grayson, this is sort of on a different end of the spectrum because my antibody levels were, my titers were 4. Mm-hmm. And I have looked back at his labs later to realize that right after birth, you know, there's a calculation in the AAP guidelines for the rate of rise of bilirubin that indicates hemolytic jaundice. And he met that criteria for a really immediate rate of rise in the first day of life.
Wow, that's interesting.
But it was, so it was slowly rising, but not to the point of needing treatment. And so I'm curious what you would have done in this situation, because I don't know if this was the ideal way to do it, honestly. Mm-hmm. But he was discharged with me at maybe 3 days old. Mm-hmm. And we knew it was kind of going up, but he wasn't near phototherapy threshold. So he was discharged and we went straight to the pediatrician who was in the same hospital system. So it was all together with the, you know, OB, NICU, hematology, and the peds. They could all see everything together. So I went straight to the pediatrician and had daily labs taken. And he peaked at like a level of 14 or 15, maybe at day 6. And we were watching even on the weekends. And then it did slowly creep back down without intervention. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? How do you feel about that story?
I probably would have done the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. With the highest, my highest titer was 4. And it's not Kel, right?
Right.
So it was S, anti-S.
Yeah.
And E. But did he have E and S? We don't know.
I don't know. I think he had.
Oh. For some reason, I thought one of them, Connor, was
he definitely had
negative.
E. No. Oh. He certainly had E.
Him up.
But S was heterozygous. So just a maybe on
S. Yeah. Well, yeah. We do have 2. What was the E titer?
The E was 2, the S was 4.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I probably would have done what you did. It's so much easier when you have a collaborative pediatrician who's like, let's do this together, right?
And I had the benefit of living near a large academic hospital system. So I think it's just a really nuanced decision because I knew everybody was kind of all in the same place and we could send records very, very easy. Well, immediately. So
And if he's not like super close to treatment level on day 3, and he's not like shooting up with his Billy levels, I probably would have done the exact same thing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully that's a helpful. I feel like we just went through a bunch of good case studies, actually.
Sure. Because we have so many children.
There we go.
Oh, man.
Let's go on to the other main risk our babies might face after they're home from the hospital, which is hemolytic anemia.
Yes. Okay. So in this case, after hospital discharge, we're usually talking about delayed onset hemolytic anemia, and it's probably the biggest risk for our babies after hospital discharge. And it's different, like we've said before, it's different from that hyperbilirubinemia because this is a quiet creep over weeks sometimes after birth where the baby's hemoglobin levels can drop, and this can take us by surprise, you know? And I think that it's weird that our babies can be away from that source of risk, which is the mother's immune system. They can have normal hemoglobin levels at birth or at hospital discharge, and then somehow become anemic weeks later. Like that's still, I know all of the like biological reasoning behind it, but it's still kind of surprising even to me. Right. So there are several factors at play here that can cause this delayed anemia for our babies. And we've said this many times in this episode alone and other episodes, but those maternal antibodies, they cross the placenta during pregnancy, and then they don't just vanish at birth, because actually the mother's immune system stays in the baby for those weeks after birth to protect the baby, right? Because the baby hasn't had time to create his own immune system. And so, unfortunately, these red cell antibodies are part of our baby's immune system in those first few weeks of life.
And another factor at play there is bone marrow suppression, especially so for anti-Kell pregnancies. And it's quite common in babies with HDFN because new red blood cells are created in the bone marrow. And if a baby's red blood cells are being destroyed, the bone marrow needs to create even more new red blood cells to replace them. So we can measure how well a baby is making new blood cells by looking at the reticulocyte count, which we usually call retic for short. And the reticulocyte count is a measure of how many immature blood cells are in the bloodstream. So these are future red blood cells, and they can give an idea of how quickly a baby is making new blood to replace what the antibodies are destroying. So an HDFN baby should actually have a higher than normal retic because they're trying to make up for the blood that's being lost. But we often see our babies with low or even non-existent retics, which means that they're not making enough new red blood cells to compensate for the lost ones that they're experiencing.
Right. Yes. I just had a mom reach out a few weeks ago. Her baby had severe HDFN, and she was concerned because the retic was way above normal range. And so she felt really reassured when I was like, actually, that's where it should
be. That's great. Yeah.
Because your baby is compensating for all of these lost red blood cells. And so this is actually really, really good to see. And the baby's really kicking it into gear and filling in, you know, those missing red blood cells. So that's good. And she felt really good about that. But why is this? Why does this happen? Why do our babies struggle sometimes to produce enough new red blood cells? So there's a few reasons for this. I won't go to super detailed explanations here. But one of the main reasons is if you have anti-K antibodies, like I do, these antibodies don't just destroy the baby's red blood cells. They can also target the bone marrow and suppress the fetal bone marrow so that it can't make new red blood cells. And this is part of the reason why anti-Kell antibodies has a lower critical titer threshold, because it's working against the baby in these two ways. And so after birth, our Kell babies can often still have that suppressed ability to make new red blood cells. Another reason why our babies might have suppressed bone marrow is if they have had intrauterine transfusions. When our babies in utero become anemic, they are supplied, hopefully, with donor red cells, and to help the baby fill in for the missing red blood cells and treat that fetal anemia. And so when this happens, the baby's body, which is so incredible that it does this, gets the signal, oh, hey, an outside source is providing red blood cells. I don't need to make new ones.
We're good here.
Everything's being handled, because it is. It should be. With a good MFM, it should be, right? And then they're born, and it's like, no. Hey, you need to kick it into gear, start making your own red blood cells. But the only way for our babies' bodies to get that signal is to drop low enough and get the understand that there's not an outside source. So if your baby has had IUTs, this is very likely that your baby's going to struggle to make new red blood cells. Another reason is if they have had their red blood cells being destroyed in utero, having that hemolysis before birth, that really does put a lot of strain on the baby to make the new red cells, right? That red cell production, which is erythropoiesis. And so over time, the baby's system gets really exhausted and they struggle to keep that production going, you know? And this can lead to low erythropoietin production. And so then that hormone is not stimulating red blood cell production. So all of these things can combine to just make it really hard for our babies sometimes to compensate for the red cells that are destroyed by the mom's antibodies.
Yeah. So we have a baby whose red blood cells are being destroyed, and this baby could also be incapable temporarily of creating new red blood cells. So it makes sense that these babies need to be watched closely, and they sometimes need a little help bringing up those red cell counts with a top-up transfusion, which is just adding some blood.
Right. And then another factor that plays into this is that our babies are growing, right? They really start growing a lot and putting on those pounds after birth. And bigger babies need more blood. They need more red blood cells. And so this can contribute to a drop in their red cell count. And then also, if the baby has received IUTs, that donor blood they were given in utero can start to die off. And so a lot of this is kind of happening around the same time, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks after birth. And this is why it's so important that our HDFN babies should receive these weekly CBCs, a complete blood count. It's a blood draw, and it tests for at least the hemoglobin, hematocrit, and reticulocyte count. It's also good to look at the baby's neutrophils and platelets sometimes. What am I forgetting, Molly? Anything else?
I think those are the big ones.
The main ones at this point in their HDFN timeline kind of is the hemoglobin and retic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes they won't do a hematocrit, right? It might just be one or the other, but I feel like it's usually hemoglobin.
Yeah,
do you think?
It is. Maybe we need to ask some providers to explain this, but usually when they're doing IUTs, intrauterine transfusions, they're really looking at hematocrit. And then post-birth, they seem to look at the hemoglobin more.
I don't know why that is.
Either one, I think they work. But, you know, just a reminder that the hemoglobin is typically about one-third what the hematocrit is. So if you really want to know what the hematocrit is, just multiply the hemoglobin times 3, and you can get a general idea of what the hematocrit is. And so when we get these weekly test results for the first few weeks, at least after birth, we should look at these results in relation to the whole picture. And that's how we can make a really good, well-informed decision about when a baby needs a transfusion. So these weekly lab values tell us the full story of what's going on inside our baby's bodies. And if we see a steadily declining hemoglobin and then a pretty consistently low retic, we can know, oh, this baby's dropping, becoming more anemic, and this baby is not producing new red blood cells. So it's probably you're probably heading toward a transfusion. And remember that the way to signal the baby's body and help kick that erythropoiesis into gear and make those new red blood cells is to let the baby drop low and really understand that it needs to make its own red blood cells. It's not coming from an outside source. And that's why it's important to try to let the hemoglobin get low enough to send that message to the baby so that it can get that retic up. And it really is such a balance. You know, it's like, oh, do we transfuse? We get so many questions about this, don't we, Molly?
Yes.
It's like, you know, oh, my baby's anemic, and so it's below normal level. Should we transfuse? And they're so young. It's like this small little guy.
I know. And it's scary because especially when you're watching the hemoglobin drop, you feel like you want to do something.
I know.
It's really tempting. Like, can we just do something now?
I know.
But it is important, like you said, we need to teach the body what it feels like to realize, oh, shoot, I need to work for this. I need to make some more blood. Not to the point that it would be consequential to the child or cause any other issues with breathing or feeding and things like that. So, you know, going back to the guidelines that we shared about a few episodes ago, that's why there's a guideline in there that they recommend against routinely transfusing if the hemoglobin is higher than 7 when the baby is born at term and otherwise doing well and doesn't need respiratory support. But there are still times, especially for the really little ones or the ones who are born early or the ones who aren't oxygenating well, where perhaps a little bit higher might be appropriate to transfuse. And that's kind of why I think there's a lot of question marks about this, because there actually aren't very, very firm transfusion thresholds for when are we definitely going to do this. And sometimes it differs by hospital, too. And we actually do have, I think we should paste a link to our excellent neonatal care practices resource, because in there we do provide specific transfusion thresholds that two different hospitals that we really love use. One is Leiden University, one is Intermountain Health, which Dr. Tim Barr is at. And they're a little bit different, but it just gives you a good, it gives you a good baseline that you can kind of think about when you're following along with your baby's care.
Yeah, I like that. Kind of gives you a range, right?
Yeah.
Having both of those different sets of thresholds. So this really is an art to manage all of this and provide the right care for our babies. And we talked about a little bit, you know, if we don't let them drop low enough, they can have transfusion dependence. And this is because if you have a baby who's, let's say their hemoglobin is dropping or it's kind of borderline, their retic is starting to rise. And that means the body is receiving that signal, oh, loud and clear, I need to respond and make these new red blood cells. But if you were to transfuse that baby too early, then it could send these mixed signals and the baby's like, oh, well, I don't need to keep doing this because there's another outside source providing the blood. And so then their retic drops again, and then there's not enough blood production. And then it becomes this cycle of transfusion dependence. And it's really hard to get out of that cycle. And so a strong rising retic is often a sign that your baby is either turning the corner or about to turn the corner, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And it's also, it's really fun to watch the whole picture. Fun. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. It's also stressful.
For nerds. Yeah. Yeah. It's
fun.
That's
for
true.
Nerds. Okay. It's fun
as
for
the
nerds.
Mom. It's not super fun.
No. Yeah. It's really not fun. But having this picture of like watching over the weeks, where is this going? Yeah. What is happening with the retic? And I agree. I feel like sometimes transfusions, if they have one or two, and then they're watching and the hemoglobin is still kind of dropping.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, the retic starts to come up, and then we get to say, I know it's still dropping the hemoglobin, but let's keep watching. It might start creeping back up now, and that might be the baby's last transfusion.
Right.
It is interesting to watch the trajectories for sure, which is another reason why the weekly checks are so important.
Yes.
They give you so much information. So another important thing to be aware of is as those red cells are destroyed, the baby's hemoglobin level can slowly drop, not fast though. So sometimes it's gradual. It's not always obvious. There's not, sometimes there's not an urgent, dramatic event that makes you say, oh my gosh, I need to take my baby in to be checked. Sometimes the babies can become pale, extra sleepy, difficult to feed, or just feel off in a way that you might feel like you should dismiss it. Or sometimes they act completely normal. I mean, they're kind of used to being anemic. So it's not really their first rodeo of being anemic. So especially if they've had IUTs or post-birth transfusions already,
they're
accustomed. Yeah. So they might be less likely to show visible symptoms. So that's, again, a reason why the weekly labs are important. And another thing to consider with helping these babies who are struggling to make enough red blood cells is giving erythropoietic stimulating agents. We call them ESAs. And the two main ones are erythropoietin or darbepoietin. And they work the same way. They just have different dosing regimens. And so we shared this in the guidelines, too, that they have been shown in clinical studies, which is like actually hard to come by for HDFN, that when you give it, it does tend to reduce the number of top-up transfusions needed by about one transfusion. So that's an option. Mm-hmm. Some families still say, well, it's still a weekly injection, and I'd rather not do weekly injections and just take the chance of needing another transfusion. And some families say, yeah, I'd love to avoid a transfusion. Let's do this. So it's on the table.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. We never talked about EPO or ESAs with my babies, but I kind of think that has something to do with my extremely high antibody titer, and that we knew that even if the baby was producing, at that point at least earlier on, producing more red blood cells, it would be destroyed by my Kell antibodies. And by the way, this is really helpful for some moms. You can actually ask your provider about potentially testing the baby for antibodies. So that would be an indirect Coombs test, or what's the other one called?
Indirect agglutination test, IAT.
Yeah. And so basically you're giving the baby an antibody screen, and then the result will tell you if the baby has your antibody still in its system.
Yeah, it's cool. It's literally the same test that diagnoses us. It's the test that's run the in the first trimester of pregnancy.
Yeah.
It says there's antibodies in here.
Yes.
So if the baby still has antibodies inside from the mom circulating, that test would be positive.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It is it is an art. That's a perfect example. It's like, we could do this.
And our pediatric hematologist actually followed my baby's Kel titers that was still in their system. And that's how we knew for sure that once those antibodies were out, the retic was going up, we were really turning the corner. And so...
Yeah. But on that note, I want to be clear. Sometimes we get questions a lot where the family thinks that the baby is now going to have this disease when they're older.
Oh, yeah.
It's very confusing. Even though we're saying, a newborn baby with HDFN might have a Kel titer if they're Bethany's kids, that's just Bethany's residual antibodies floating around. And once those are processed and die off, the baby doesn't have antibodies. Not a thing for the baby.
Yes, thank you. That's a part of that baby, like, retaining the mother's immune system, right? To protect the baby as it starts to make its own immune system when they're so young. And then all of the maternal antibodies die off, including these red cell antibodies. And then they're gone forever. Another thing that your pediatrician or hematologist might check during your baby's blood tests are the white blood cells, also called the neutrophils, and the platelets, also called thrombocytes. And babies with HDFN can occasionally drop low on their white blood cell count and their platelets. And this is because the baby's body is working so hard to produce more and more red blood cells as they're being destroyed that the body kind of takes its attention off of these other things that need to be produced in the blood. And so a low neutrophil or white blood cell count can mean that your baby could potentially have trouble fighting off infection or be more susceptible to illness. And then if your baby has low platelets, your baby might need a platelet infusion, but this is rare on both in both cases. This is usually something that resolves completely on its own. And if your doctor is not looking at those levels, you could potentially ask your doctor, hey, could you just check my baby's neutrophils and thrombocytes, the platelets, and just kind of follow those.
After hearing all those details about the intricacies of post-birth HDFN, let's talk about the role of the pediatric hematologist and whether and when we need one. So there's not a clear boundary for how are you certain that you need to be in a pediatric hematologist office after discharge? Whether you have needed treatment already for HDFN or your baby has or not, and whether you have high titers or not, you need to know who your pediatric hematologist is going to be, period, I think. And I think that for me, if someone were to ask me this question, how do I know if I need to see a pediatric hematologist? It's important to know who that person's going to be because you don't want to have to do a blood transfusion in the emergency room. You want to do it in the pediatric hematologist office. Your pediatrician can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is wise, even if you have a low titer, you didn't need any intervention, and the baby hasn't yet needed intervention, to establish care with that person. Have the care team in the hospital consult with the pediatric hematologist and say, I have this family. How do you feel about this care plan? Do you want to see them or not? And then you could decide from there. But the family needs to know who that person is. But I would say if the family has a high titer, has already needed treatment, or looks like they're going to need treatment, you got to get in that person's office. But again, it all starts with getting a consult no matter what. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's good. I think you covered it. What we don't want is to be in this like urgent time situation where the baby really does need a transfusion and the baby's not even in the system yet, right?
Yes.
And then it becomes urgent because you do have to find donor blood that is matched to the mom's antibodies. And so they have to find that special blood to transfuse. And, you know, sometimes that can take a whole day, sometimes longer. And so if you just already have yourself, your baby established as a patient with a hematologist, at least, and then you also have that collaborative pediatrician, like we were talking about earlier, then the pediatrician can cover those weekly blood tests. If you start seeing a downward trend, you know, then they can see the hematologist. But for me, in my situation, we knew from the beginning, I had such severe disease, we would definitely need to have a pediatric hematologist. And so my MFMs did not allow my baby to be discharged from the hospital until he had spoken with our pediatric hematologist himself and made sure that I had a follow-up appointment that week with the hematologist scheduled. And so that was very helpful. That was with my last three babies. And yeah, even though we had the hematologist, they still collaborated with our pediatrician.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was good. Yeah.
Okay. Really good point. I think people have that question a lot. And the other question they always have is, how do we know that my baby is finally cleared from HDFN?
Okay. That is such a good question. How do we know when we're actually at that finish line and the baby is totally medically cleared from HDFN? That's what we're all moving towards. So this is how you can know. If your baby has increasing or stable normal hemoglobin values. So let me just clarify that. If your baby has stable and normal hemoglobin values or increasing hemoglobin values on two consecutive measurements, and that should be like two consecutive weeks, not like two consecutive days, but two consecutive weeks going up after birth. And this is not, they're not going up because you had a transfusion. The baby is bringing them up on his own, and the retic also is going up. Then you can know that the HDFN is resolved and baby should be in the clear.
That is the real finish line.
I know.
And it's worth celebrating. I feel like it's like another birthday. I love when the moms in our group post, we're cleared. It's so exciting.
It is such a great feeling to know, like, oh my gosh, I can just have a normal baby. I can just, now I can address all of the other difficult parenting things.
Oh, just beginning,
you know?
Just beginning.
Oh, but just for some perspective, my babies were finally discharged. Their levels finally went up 2 weeks in a row when they were about 15 weeks old. So that was like, you know, that took a long time. Mm-hmm. I was so done by that point. And a lot of moms are just like, please make it end. Mm. It is so hard to watch your baby get their blood drawn week after week. Oh man, emotionally, that would send me into a spiral. Even though I know it's what's best for them, even though I know it's for their own safety, it was so hard. And so just know, like, oh, I don't have to keep following these blood counts. I don't have to keep sticking my little baby, and then they're done. And so, yeah, you made it.
We made it.
Yay.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Okay. Whether you're a patient, provider, or otherwise affected by antibodies in pregnancy, we are here for you. We have great resources on our website at allohopefoundation.org. That's allo spelled A-L-L-O, hopefoundation.org.
Thanks for listening.
The Allo Podcast is offered by the Allo Hope Foundation, a nonprofit organization. This means that our ability to continue this work depends on corporate sponsorships, small research grants, and donations. While sponsorships and grants are vital, they're often restricted to specific activities, and they do not cover the everyday work that keeps our mission moving. Things like creating educational materials, writing grant applications, running our social media, and especially managing our rapidly growing patient support group where we counsel women every day. They also do not cover the direct support we provide to families who cannot access life-saving care, whether that's the cost of an antibody screen in Kenya or bus fare for a mom in the U.S. who needs to travel for an intrauterine transfusion. If you've ever wondered whether a donation of any size makes an impact, it truly does. Please visit our show notes for information on how to donate to AHF or to become a recurring donor. Your support gives our small organization the stability we need to continue this work and ensure no family faces HDFN alone.
The Aloe Podcast is a production of the Aloe Hope Foundation and is sponsored by Johnson & Johnson. It is researched and written by Bethany Weathersby and Molly Sherwood, and produced and edited by CJ Hausch and Eric Hurst of Media Club.